Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM. This is Norm Diamond, your host and the producer of today's program, as well as a significant part of its on-air talent, is Patricia Colburn. As I hope you know, KBOO is an extraordinary resource for the community, providing thoughtful coverage of what's covered only superficially elsewhere or isn't covered at all. It's alternative media of which you are now listening to one of the country's outstanding examples that provides not only reliable news, but needed perspective. Listener support is crucial, accounting for something like 80% of the station's funding. If you're able, please become a member or send a donation. Go to kboo.fm/donate or send a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. One of the things we do here at the Old Mole's underground burrow at that Southeast 8th Avenue address is celebrate. We celebrate victories toward a better society, of course, but we also celebrate struggle toward that end, whether it brings us immediate victory or not. We grow in struggle. We develop our sense of capabilities and our understanding. We test out the possibilities and expand our sense of what we'd like to achieve. It's not only that we have to struggle in order to win, true as that is, it's also that we become the kind of people capable of winning, capable of building something fundamentally better only through struggle. On today's program, we highlight various forms of struggle, past and present, international and local. We'll revisit the issue of race norming, a practice that started out as progressive, or at least well-intentioned. Like so much else in this society, race norming has been distorted into yet another example of discrimination and divisiveness in areas ranging from medical practice to professional sports. Patricia Kohlberg will comment on the concept and read from a recent piece by sports writer Dave Zirin. It's not the football that interests her, but the racism disguised as science. For our segment, Another World is Possible, I'll conclude our look back at the Paris Commune on this, its 150th anniversary. I'll respond to some listener critiques of the earlier segment and explore what's still relevant from that historic event. And to open the program, Bill Resnick talks with Richard A. Smith. Smith offers an interesting combination of expertise on both modern China and environmental issues. This is part one of a two-part interview, part two to air next week. Here's Bill Resnick with Richard A. Smith.
Richard Smith, welcome again to KBOO.
Thanks, Bill. Happy to be here again.
Richard Smith is a historian of modern China, also an environmental activist, co-founded the organization System Change, Not Climate Change. His books and writings include China's Engine of Environmental Collapse, just out this year. Previously, he wrote Green Capitalism, The God That Failed, and he's written many important articles, all quite accessible. We'll be discussing the changes that must be made in the United States and indeed world production of all kinds in near every industry, to stop burning fossil fuels and every use to which they're made, to replace that fossil fuel energy with renewable, mostly sun and wind energy, for all needed protection. We need a new transportation system and organic regenerative agriculture, all new buildings, zero carbon and retrofitting the old, also great programs in energy conservation and use reduction, and on and on and on. At least for now, only the most necessary airplane travel. No weekends in Aruba, Needless to say, the powers that be are not listening. Indeed, they can't imagine voluntarily slowing down, and they reject the need to reduce production and greenhouse gases. Even those who don't deny that global warming is a problem, our elites have developed their solution, our elites and companies. It is a green capitalism. Richard Smith, you challenged that in your book, Green Capitalism, The Guide That Failed. Tell us why.
Here's the basic problem. We need to, as the scientists tell us, we need to dramatically and rapidly suppress emissions. But we live in economies that are built on growth. In the United States, in the West, we live in capitalist economies that cannot exist without growth. They must constantly grow to generate new profits, to generate new jobs, and so on and so forth. So we come across this at every point, because to suppress emissions means to suppress production, because emissions are not separable. There are no areas where it's possible to separate CO2 emissions from production, except in one area. There is one area which we can get kind of a freebie here, and that is energy generation, electricity generation. We can replace fossil fuel power plants with solar and wind, and that will get us clean energy, albeit, of course, there are costs involved, environmental costs involved in producing those wind turbines and solar panels and so forth like that. But that's really the only field across the rest of the industrial structure. In manufacturing, in mining, in steel production, non-ferrous metals like aluminum, cement, aviation, shipping, transportation, chemicals, vehicle, heavy truck transportation, chemicals, plastics, textiles, electronics, all of these industries, they're what are called the hard-to-abate industries. That is, yes, we can suppress emissions in energy generation, electricity production, and most of the discussion in the U.S., the West, and China and so forth is about substituting solar panels and wind for coal and natural gas or fossil fuel power. And that's good as far as it goes, but that's only coal production, for example. Fossil fuel production of electricity only accounts for a third of China's emissions, even less in the U.S., about 25%. So suppressing those alone will be good. That's a big step, but it's not enough. All of these other industries, the metals, the cement, the shipping, chemicals, the plastics, all these kinds of things, there are no easy solutions for them. The difficulties are immense. And, you know, there are always talks about tech fixes, oh, well, we can have hydrogen produce steel and so forth. And yes, you could do that someday, maybe, but it requires an immense build out of infrastructure of electrolyzers to produce hydrogen from water rather than from fossil fuel and so forth like that. So there are some possible changes in the way, way distant future, but we need to suppress emissions this decade and next decade. If we don't do it in the next two decades or so, there is no hope for humanity. We're just doomed. I mean, we just cannot keep growing emissions at the rate we're going. Like China's emissions are going at 5% per year. And China's emissions are already double those of the U.S. China accounts for 30% of world CO2 emissions. The U.S. accounts for 15%, the EU 7%, and so on down the line. So the biggest emitters are China and the U.S. They account for nearly half the world's emissions. And the only way, I've argued in my paper, in my book on China's engine of environmental collapse, the only way to suppress those emissions in the near term, right now, is to suppress the emissions. That is, you have to, in these difficult industries, there is no choice but to, as George Monbiot of The Guardian wrote with respect to aviation, there is no tech fix. The growth in aviation and the need to address climate change cannot be reconciled. A 90% cut in emissions requires not only that growth stops, but that most of the planes which are flying today are grounded. I recognize this is not a popular message, but it's hard to see how a different conclusion can be extracted from the available evidence. It's the basic engine of capitalism, the basic growth-driven engine of capitalism that is the problem. The only way to suppress those emissions in the short term is to park the cars, ground the planes, stop producing so much steel, so much aluminum, stop shipping stuff from China and all over the world, stop production of synthetic textiles, which are all based on oil, fossil fuels, stop producing endless new gadgets to consume electricity that require all these chemicals and chips and so on and so forth. None of this anybody wants to hear about. I read about this stuff, but nobody wants to hear about this stuff, because who wants to suppress economic growth? And yet, if we don't, we're just writing our death warrant. scientists are tired of telling us, look, people, wake up here, you got to do something. But we can't because we live in this economic system. So the only alternative really is to demand rapid phase outs of the oil industry and the auto industry and many industries. I'm not saying we shouldn't have any cars. Of course, we need some cars, but cars could be designed, you know, like old Volkswagen Beetles, you know, to be endlessly rebuildable and upgradable and so forth. But instead, the model, annual model industry, model year change, which was innovated by GM back in the 1920s as a way to sell more and more cars, instead of building cars to last forever, they're built to last as short a possible time as possible. And they lard the cars with dashboard video displays, which are dangerous at any speed, you know, electric heating of your steering wheel and your seats and on and on and on to sell ever more cars and consume ever more resources. This whole structure, this whole set of motivations needs to be cashiered. We just cannot, on a finite planet, we just cannot have an ever-growing economy. That's the U.S. economy. The Chinese economy has different drivers, which I talked about in my book. Profit motivation is not the main thing. But still, the engine of Chinese growth is built on the desire of Xi Jinping and the Communist Party to catch up and overtake the U.S., and they pull out all the stops to do that. So that means building just endless amounts of infrastructure and, you know, satellites to the moon and so forth. You know, this is just crazy. Both of these systems are just crazy. They're suicidal. They're just driving us to collapse.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on cable. We've been discussing what must be done and soon to stop the global warming apocalypse. And you sort of anticipated what we're going to do next week, Richard, which is discuss, in view of that problem and in view of the fact that right now the suppression of all those industries is a non-starter almost in American discussions, except on the left, where we talk about degrowth and defunding.
Even on the left, it's a non-starter.
It's hard to do, but at least some of the journals are doing it. In the mainstream press, you don't get it at all. We'll talk about that next week. At some point, when climate disasters get a lot worse, when they're more dangerous, frequent, killing hundreds and thousands and millions of people in parts of New York City and all of New Orleans, except a few little hilltops, are underwater, then people are going to realize how terrible the threat that climate change creates. That could happen in 5 to 10 years, that moment of awakening. So next week, we're going to really be talking about that and what can be done. Richard, I'd like this week to talk a little more about when we, in fact, reach that point, the left will have to have a solution ready and one that could work to convince people that utter austerity might last for a few years, but their life would really improve if we, in fact, then began moving towards a very, very different economic protection system and the way people live. And we have to develop that. So I was hoping today that we could talk about the changes that are needed in industry. And auto is really a wonderful subject to talk about because we are going to need some, as you pointed out, we need some auto industry, but it really has to change very radically within a very different transportation system. You've written quite well on that and eloquently. Give us your ideas of the transportation system, particularly the auto part, which is not the major part in our planning, but it still is extremely important. Give us a sense of the transportation industry and the role of autos and what our auto industrial capacity should actually be devoted to.
Well, so autos are, of course, they've been for decades, they were the second biggest industry after housing in the United States, after construction and housing. So autos were the largest industry, the largest employer, and so on and so forth. But the whole thing is based on repetitive consumption, on designed-in obsolescence, on persuading you to buy the next model car. And so the solution is largely seen by many in the liberal media and also even on the left that, oh, well, if we just get electric cars, that will solve the whole problem of pollution. Well, that won't solve the whole problem of pollution because as one study I cited in a discussion of autos showed, the amount of pollution resulting from, you know, over the life cycle of a gasoline-powered automobile the amount of pollution that's produced before the vehicle leaves the showroom is more than will ever come out of the tailpipe over the average 7 to 8 year lifespan of the car. And that was, you know, some years ago, this is all gasoline powered cars. And actually manufacturing electric vehicles is even more polluting than manufacturing gasoline powered vehicles, mostly because of the batteries and so forth. There's a study of this cited in my articles and my book. So the point is, if you replace gasoline power vehicles with electric power vehicles, but you still have the same built-in driver of obsolescence, then you end up simply throwing away perfectly good vehicles and all the pollution that results from that and carrying on the same built-in problem of capitalism. It's true, you can reduce the emissions dramatically by switching to electric, but all of the production that goes into making the car, the steel, the aluminum, the lithium, the batteries, and so on and so forth, that goes into making a car, which is ultimately, in America, in the U.S. and the West, a disposable product, like an iPhone. You know, you have an iPhone, and after 2 or 3 years, you know, Apple wants you to lose your phone after a couple of years or trade it in and get a new one. And they deliberately obsolesce the phones. You know, over time, the apps won't work, or the newer versions of the apps won't work, or the battery life falls down, you know. And it's a deliberate effort to get you to toss away a perfectly good phone. My old iPhone 3, Model 3S, would be a perfectly good phone. There's no reason to throw that thing away. But it could be easily adapted and updated. But they don't want to do that because that ruins their whole business model of producing endless more phones and keeping all those Chinese slave workers making them in Foxconn factories. So that's the same dynamic in the auto industry. If you made cars that could last for a long time, for decades and so forth, that were easily rebuildable and upgradable and completely recyclable and get rid of all the non-essential electronic crap in the cars and made them lightweight, super lightweight, so they don't consume much energy, either electric or gasoline powered, well, that would just put the auto industry out of business, right? And we don't want the auto industry out of business because it employs millions of people. So this is the built-in problem of capitalism. You have to grow the industry. You have to destroy the planet in order to hang on to our jobs today. This is our fate. I mean, this is capitalism. There's no technical solution to climate warming aside from the issue of wind and solar power. That is a sort of a freebie we get. We can do that. That is, we can dramatically separate the growth of that particular industry from emissions. But that's not true for almost every other industry you can think of. So any kind of economy built on perpetual growth just means consuming more resources down the line. And with battery-powered cars, you can see. I have a friend in California who leased a battery-powered Chevy Bolt. Why didn't they buy it? They didn't buy it because it makes no sense to buy an electric car because they change from year to year so fast that in 3 years, the next model Bolt will go 300 miles, whereas theirs only goes 200 miles. So who is going to want to buy a secondhand Bolt 3 years from now that only goes 200 miles on a charge? And what's more, a replacement battery costs a lot of money. You know what a replacement battery for a Tesla 3 costs? It costs $45,000, more than half the price of the car. And if the changes in batteries and technology, propulsion and so forth continue at their current pace, then each new vehicle will be obsolesced just as fast, if not faster, than the preceding one. So, you know, in 3, 4 years, 5 years, you'll have cars that will go 500 miles on a charge. And they'll charge in half an hour or 20 minutes or something like that. Well, then who is going to want to buy an old one? So you'll see rapid depreciation of value and destruction of vehicles. It just like, you know, become like iPhones.
Yeah. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mode Variety Hour on cable, talking to Richard Smith. His specialty is modern China and its economy. We've been discussing how electric cars are not the solution unless they were built to last long, long periods and the companies are not interested in them. In fact, there should be less of them and much more mass transit. We haven't gotten back to that. But there's one last issue, Richard. Some people might accuse you of being a really hard-hearted guy, wanting to suppress all those industries, putting so many people in auto and the airlines and making clothing and the fossil fuel industry, putting them out of work and desperate for their families. Do you have a defense to that charge?
In everything I write, Bill, I immediately discuss the issue of jobs creation. That is, I've called for the oil industry to be phased out and the coal industry to be virtually shut down, nearly shut down. You do need coal for a few technical processes and so forth, so you need a little bit, but not much. But I've called for the phase out of the auto industry as it exists, as a designed-in obsolescence production machine, but a downsizing of the auto industry, massive downsizing. But whenever I've called for these, I have always joined that call with a demand that the government provide WPA or equivalent new jobs for all these displaced workers at the same pay and benefits they're getting right now. That was actually in the small print of Bernie Sanders' plan, but he never really made much of a point of it, which was too bad, because most people counterpose environmentalism to kind of jobs in the economy because they understand intuitively that if we're going to suppress emissions, we have to quit making so much stuff, quit converting so much of nature to product, and that means fewer jobs. Well, unless you couple that necessity, we do need to do that. We do need to suppress industries in order to save humanity. But you have to couple that with job creation program, a job generation program, to guarantee every single one of those workers new jobs at comparable pay and benefits. That is absolutely, that has to be the starting point. I've said that in every book I've written about China, about the U.S., everywhere. And that has to be the case. That's one of the really dumb things about organizations like 350 and so forth like that just go on and on about the need to suppress emissions, and they never, ever talk about jobs. Well, you're never, ever going to get any workers to support that mission if you don't guarantee them a just transition and new jobs, not just a vague promise somehow in the future, but actually job guarantees. That has to be fundamental. It has to be the first step.
Yeah, I think I disagree with you a little. 350.org does, in fact, mention that a good deal, but you're absolutely right. It's disappointing that their major, major, major programs are in stopping coal, like the Sierra Club. But they're all moving towards recognizing that jobs, it's slow and it's not sufficient, and they really should have to change their entire rhetoric and move from just stopping fossil fuels to rebuilding our whole economy, suppressing so many industries, rebuilding our economy, which will create jobs for all.
But they can't. They can't say that because these NGOs like 350.org are supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. You think the Rockefeller Foundation wants to suppress any industry? Please.
I think that there are some capitalists who ultimately decided to go with Roosevelt because they knew in the 30s, they knew if they didn't, they would be destroyed completely. And they thought that they could maintain, then regain control and set up their system where they're in control and maintain their riches and the honor that they bestow upon themselves. Yeah, I think that the NGOs, some of them are smart enough to recognize and they will all recognize in 5 to 10 years that the world is going to have to change. And they want to be in charge of that change. Anyway, that's what we're going to talk about next week, Richard. I think I've stolen the last word for you, but we can discuss all of those issues. This was Bill Resnick for the Old Mortar on cable radio talking to Richard Smith. He's a writer of books and articles, an activist, a really soft-hearted environmentalist doing his best with comrades to save the planet, create millions of good jobs, and in the process generate the sort of movements that ultimately lead the way to a society that's radically democratic, that produces sustainably, a society in which all humans have the time, the means, the motivation to live in ways that are creative and fulfilling. This was part one of our interview. Looking forward to a discussion on what we do in the current period to make sure that when push comes to shove, a left can prevail rather than the NGOs and the capitalists who will try to recreate their system of power and control if they're able to maintain direction of the world economy. Richard, thanks a lot for talking to us.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me, Billy. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
So long.
Thanks, Bill and Richard. Now a question for you, our listeners. Have you heard of the practice called race norming? It's ostensibly a way to even out the odds between different racial groups. If members of one race consistently score lower on whatever is being tested, whether it's intelligence or kidney function, then that lower score is taken as that race's baseline, as what that race, in general terms, is capable of. I hope you see the problem already. Capability, potential, cannot be determined only by an empirical test. This is an issue I'll address in future broadcasts. For now, what if kidney function is affected by poverty and the stress of racism? In fact, it is. What if IQ tests have built-in cultural biases? They have had, and do. Then those supposed baselines have racial discrimination built in to their very premises. There are issues here about so-called progressive reforms and how they're co-opted and distorted, and about science and the changing premises on which all science rests. Yet more topics to explore in the future. For now, here's today's Well-Read Read, Patricia Kullberg.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kullberg, and I'm going to return this morning to a topic I took up nearly a year ago on The Old Mole, about the practice that began during the era of slavery, of casting African Americans as physiologically different and usually inferior to white people, in order to justify brutal repression and other racist practices that have continued well into the 21st century. Last August, I spoke with medical student Naomi Nkinsi about her organizing efforts to abolish a race correction in the calculation of kidney function, which had the effect of delaying necessary treatment for African American patients with kidney disease. Today, I'm going to be reading from an article about race norming in cognitive testing within the National Football League by Dave Zirin, who writes and publishes widely about the politics of sports. His article is entitled, "The NFL's Institutionalized Racism is Just One Part of a Massive Problem." It was published online by MSNBC on June 8, 2021. Race norming and cognitive testing was not the NFL's idea. They got it from American medicine. The establishment of a lower standard in African Americans rose out of the observation that blacks tended to score lower than whites on standardized tests of cognitive function. But the tests were themselves flawed in multiple ways. Cultural and linguistic factors, for example, were not taken into account, and non-scientific definitions of race were used. As documented by a comprehensive review in the New England Journal of Medicine just a year ago, the practice of creating different clinical standards for African Americans was often driven by an impulse to improve care for black patients, but in nearly all cases, the effect was to worsen their outcomes. And so it is with race norming within the NFL, which has meant that black players must be more cognitively impaired than their white counterparts to qualify for the same compensation for traumatic brain injury. And maybe worse, race norming like this reinforces notions of African-American difference and inferiority that have been demonstrated over and over again to have no basis in science. Here's Dave Zirin's piece, which is edited slightly for length. "You wouldn't have hired Jesse James to stop train robberies. You'd never have turned to Bernie Madoff to clean up Wall Street. And this is why the National Football League's contention that it will be a leading voice to stop the practice of race norming used in the world of cognitive testing rings so false. The league has benefited immensely from the practice, which has been used to curve the scores of cognitive tests of black players based on the theory that their starting baseline for intelligence is lower than that of other racial groups. With this approach, the league, according to former black players who have sued it, has been able to deny black athletes their share of a $1 billion concussion settlement by effectively arguing that their low cognitive scores are not due to concussions or early onset dementia, but because of the color of their skin. Given this, it makes little sense to trust the NFL to lead the charge in abolishing race norming. The only hope is to name and shame the practice, to expose it to produce the requisite shock and outrage so many people felt when the story first came to light. Unfortunately, much of the sports media treated these revelations at most as a one-day story, but it's not. Beyond the realm of pro sports, this type of institutionalized racism in medicine has been part of this country since the first enslaved people were brought to American shores. Then it was argued by doctors that black people had a smaller lung capacity than white people, were more likely to ward off some infections, and had lower intelligence, all of which, according to the so-called science of the day, made them divinely suited for slavery. Similar arguments have been used historically for denying black people access to education, jobs, and quite famously, to integrated sports, which meant competing against whites, in the early 20th century. One may feel horrified by reports of the NFL using race norming to mete out financial claims and essentially save money, but the NFL is only part of a larger problem. This practice is still very much a part of neurology and cognitive testing to this day. It's practically phrenologist pornography. The root of race norming tells a story in and of itself about the limits of attempting to legislate a cure for racial inequity. In the 1970s, in the aftermath of the Black Freedom Struggle, race norming as a phrase was first used by President Jimmy Carter's administration in federal job aptitude tests and to round standardized test scores of black students up to account for cultural biases in the tests, as well as disproportionate poverty and underfunded schools. It was also used by his Department of Labor as a way to even the inequities of government contracts, which had always favored white-owned companies. This practice was seen as so commonsensical that it was adopted by Ronald Reagan's administration and was a continual practice until ending it became a right-wing cause célèbre. Right-wing talk radio picked it up as a way to depict liberal social engineering. In 1991, conservative commentator George Will called it, quote, liberalism's apartheid of compassion. In response to this pressure from the right, President George H.W. Bush outlawed race norming for government contracts and as a Department of Education practice as part of his painfully misnamed 1991 Civil Rights Act. Yet, in the world of cognitive testing, the practice and theories of race norming not only survived, but thrived, as we can see in the instance of the NFL, where it has been used not to cure racial inequity, but to expand it. This is why the hope for ending the ugly neurological practice of race norming will not come from NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell leading any kind of a charge against racism. This is a league that has just a handful of black head coaches and executives and no black franchise owners, while 70% of the players are black. This should be a story we continue to follow and report on, to hold the NFL and the medical community's feet to the fire until the practice is altogether abolished. It is a stark reminder that, to paraphrase an old saying, you aren't going to tear down the master's house with the master's tools. Confronting systemic racism will require a rethinking of entire systems baked into the cake of this country, not by codifying racial differences in a manner that will inevitably be used against black advancement when it inevitably falls into racist hands. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been reading an online article by sports writer Dave Zirin, published by MSNBC on June 8, 2021.
Thank you, Patricia. Did you know that only a small proportion of our listeners are actually donors or members? I'll bet you knew that, Patricia. KABU reaches a wide audience, but it needs support to continue to be an important part of this community, the important part that it is. You can donate today at kboo.fm/give, or you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Community radio around the country has been forced to cut back or close. The dedicated staff and volunteers here in Portland have kept KABU going strong. If you're able, please help. And now, another world is possible. A couple of months ago, I did an episode commemorating the 150th anniversary of the 1871 Paris Commune. If you missed it, it's at the Old Mole site on kboo.fm for April 12th of this year. The commune was destroyed on May 28th, so we're a bit past the commemoration. It's time to reflect on its continuing influence and the lessons it offered. Here's part two on the Paris Commune. Back when the Occupy movement was at its height, one of the arrested activists gave police her name as Louise Michel. The police, of course, had no idea of her historical reference. Louise Michel was a famous participant in the Paris Commune. Calling up her name is an indication 150 years later that the Commune continues to inspire and resonate today. Michel was one of the pétroleuses, the female firebrands spreading petrol, burning down the established order. That at least was the rhetoric of the forces that ultimately destroyed this self-proclaimed République des Travailleurs, Workers' Republic, outraged, among other things, by the Commune's strong participation and leadership from women. One of the few who survived the horrific massacre by bourgeois troops that ended the Commune, Louise Michel was sentenced to exile in a French penal colony somewhere east of Australia. In April, Another World is Possible did part one on the Paris Commune. You can find that program by going to the Old Mole website on kboo.fm for April 12th. That episode covered some of the accomplishments of the Commune, the way workers who seized power rethought what the state should be and how they, workers, could administer it. Rethought education and culture and childcare, moved to eliminate colonialism, capitalism, nationalism, and wars. That episode focused on the role of women. It could just as easily have focused on the way in which workers in power transformed the very nature of work itself. One's labor, no longer a commodity to be sold to an employer, but an activity undertaken for the benefit of society. All this in just 72 days, from March 18th to May 28th. A couple of Old Mole listeners raised challenges to our account. One wondered why we paid so much attention to a localized, relatively brief event so long ago, why it mattered when historically it had so little chance of success. Another, acknowledging the Commune's importance, thought we should simply have relied on Karl Marx's classic account of it, rather than highlighting areas we think are of most interest now. Both these challenges to the Old Mole program raise interesting and complex questions. The first revolves around what we mean by success. You may have heard the folk wisdom that the struggle for a better society will be a series of lost battles until we win the war. That may be too bleak a prediction, but our gains are seldom straightforward. Today's episode on race norming is a case in point. Each advance occasions a backlash, and reforms are frequently co-opted, but we build our understanding and capacities in the course of struggle. That's what will pay off further down the road. We look to the Seattle General Strike of 1919, for instance, even though it lasted only 6 days, because it demonstrated that ordinary workers could take over the running of a city closer to home. The Paris Commune, though it lasted but 72 days, provided inspiration and vision for struggles to come. One of the people it most inspired was Karl Marx. Another was Peter Kropotkin. Neither Marxism nor anarchism would be what they are today had the Paris Commune not happened. It forced Marx to engage politically in ways he had not before, to descend from the realm of abstraction to the realm of strategy and tactics. What this meant concretely was, first, having to think through how to support an actually existing revolutionary effort, of which he also had criticisms. It's the same question we might face with regard to contemporary Cuba or Venezuela. Do we sit back and point out all their faults? Or do we attempt to empathize with their difficulties and dilemmas and offer our critiques in the context of support? Marx's initial response was one of revolutionary purity, of abstraction. The Paris Commune was not fully living up to his abstract vision for what a proletarian revolution should be. Realizing the inadequacy of that position, learning how to offer critical support, made Marx all the more effective in responding to real-life worker struggles. It also was the lessons he took from the Paris Commune that turned him to the study of the Russian obshchina, the peasant communes, and turned him away from his rigid notion that all societies had to pass through the same exact stages before having a chance to achieve his vision of the better society. He came to realize that different countries might have different paths to socialism. Finally, in light of the Commune, Marx reconsidered his position on what role the existing state apparatus could play under socialism and in the transition to socialism. In other words, can we just adapt the state as it is, or do we have to think of a very different type of institution to coordinate social activity and the building of a new society? As a result, he reconsidered and rewrote part of the Communist Manifesto from 2.5 decades before. If you take a look, he talks explicitly in the new preface about how the Paris Commune caused him to change his views. For Kropotkin, the impact of the Paris Commune was even greater. The revolutionary efforts by Parisian workers persuaded him that fundamental social change was possible, and that it, and not his impressive scholarly work in geography, was his true vocation. As to the second challenge, why not simply rely on Marx's superb account of the Commune in his book, The Civil War in France? I think I've partly answered that already, both in emphasizing the role of women in our last episode, an emphasis different from Marx's, and in talking today about the change in his own perspective. There's a further reason. Marx was writing for activists of his own time and for the future. He was condensing events and highlighting lessons, not aiming at an account as a historian might write it. As we think about what's important to us, our lessons and questions overlap with what Marx highlighted, but aren't the same. Before we turn to those lessons and questions, here's some of the music from the Commune, a song about dreams and love, but also suffering and heartache, a gentle, reflective anthem, maybe not what you'd expect from a militant revolution. I played and discussed a couple versions of the first stanza last time. Here are the following three stanzas of Le Temps des Cerises, The Time of the Cherries, or Of the Cherry Blossoms, composed by Jean-Baptiste Clément, a participant in the Paris Commune.
Mais il est bien court le temps des cerises où l'on s'en va de cueillir en rêvant des pendants d'oreilles. Cerises d'amour aux robes pareilles feuille en gouttes de sang. Mais il est bien court le temps des cerises pendant le corail qu'on cueille en rêvant. Quand vous en serez au temps des cerises, si vous avez peur des chagrins d'amour, évitez les belles. Moi qui ne crains pas les peines cruelles, je ne vivrai point sans souffrir un jour. Quand vous en serez au temps des cerises, vous aurez aussi des peines d'amour. J'aimerais toujours le temps des cerises, c'est de ce temps-là que je garde au cœur une plaie ouverte. Et dame fortune en m'étant offerte ne pourra jamais fermer ma douleur. J'aimerai toujours le temps des cerises et le souvenir.
That was Cora Vauquer singing my favorite version of Le Temps des Cerises. Here's another favorite, Patricia Kohlberg, with my translation.
But it's very short, the time of the cherries, where we go off dreaming to pick some earrings, cherries of love in similar dress, falling under the foliage as drops of blood. But it's very short, the time of the cherries, coral pendants that we harvest while dreaming. When you are there at the time of the cherries, if you are frightened of love's sorrows, avoid the pretty girls. I, who don't fear the cruel pains, I won't live without some day suffering. When you are there at the time of the cherries, you too will have the pains from love. I shall always love the time of the cherries. It's from that time that I keep an open wound in my heart. And Mistress Fortune, in being offered to me, will never be able to end my sadness. I shall always love the time of the cherries and the memory I guard in my heart.
So what then are our takeaways from the Paris Commune? I would emphasize these. The first is that the Commune didn't just begin on March 18th, when the history books place it, when the women of Montmartre faced off with the army, which was attempting to steal the neighborhood's means of defense, after the French army surrendered to the Prussian invaders. Rather, it was the culmination of long-term organizing. France had had popular rebellions in 1830 and 1848, the latter less than 23 years before. Veterans from that uprising were still around, still agitating, and offering advice and inspiration, much as the older Old Moles attempt now. A better instance in the U.S. might be the labor upsurge in the 1930s, and how it was heavily sprinkled with older wobblies years after U.S. government repression had disbanded much of the IWW. In Paris in 1871, as in Lyon, Marseille, and other urban centers, workers were aware of contemporary revolts in Ireland, Hungary, and Poland. They knew of the struggle to free slaves in the U.S. and serfs in Russia, and of the revolt against British colonialism in India. Working-class discussion clubs, more like political debating societies for the masses, with great popular attendance, had been meeting for at least 2 years prior. Their existence and popularity resulted from a concession workers forced on the repressive and censorious emperor, Louis-Napoleon Bonaparte, as he sought to win lower-class support for his increasingly shaky regime. Already in 1869, Parisian clubs were debating what the commune would look like, and meetings began and ended, just like old mole meetings, with the invocation, "Vive la commune!" My old mole colleagues will be excited to hear that. So, a spontaneous uprising on March 18th, yes, but the outcome of years of preparation. Just like the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955 was triggered by Rosa Parks' spontaneous action, but was really the result of years of preparation and organizing. In Paris, the Commune was the outcome, too, of a weak and incompetent government that instigated and lost a war against Prussia, and a divided ruling class. We'll come back to that divided ruling class. For our second takeaway, the Commune failed because it was isolated. Had workers in Lyon and Marseille held out, major cities that established their own communes, it would have helped. But even so, the working class by itself was insufficient. Workers in Paris knew that and tried to reach the French peasantry, but started too late and were thwarted. The French government, which had fled the city of Paris, set up a blockade around it, joining with Prussian troops, preventing physical contact between the commune and the peasantry. The mainstream press printed blatant and outrageous lies about the commune. Activist workers had not established ties to the peasantry beforehand, and now were reduced to trying to send leaflets over the blockade by hot air balloons. Confining the commune to the geographical limits of Paris raises issues that we try to address otherwise on Another World is Possible, often by looking at utopian and dystopian literature. Here I want only to indicate them. The first is whether desirable alternative forms of social organization, participatory and democratic, need to be small in scale. The communards generally thought so. The vision they came up with, the vision they offered the peasantry and workers in other countries, was a federation of communes, abolishing national boundaries, abolishing the state. The second such issue is the efficacy of building small alternatives within the confines of an exploitive society. Can co-ops, for instance, in our own society, be a means of advancing us toward a more comprehensive social transformation? Or are they instead mainly a way to carve out a bit of decent space for a few people, while even reducing pressure for change? Our third takeaway relates to the bourgeois response, to the response by those who employed the workers, the merchants and manufacturers, and their spokespeople in the realm of journalism and culture. This is the group that had gained significant economic power and some political power as a result of the French Revolution in the prior century. This is the group that would dominate France from this time forward in the Third Republic, the bourgeois republic, after the emperor was forced out. This is the group whose different interests and different perspectives from the older, rural, landowning class resulted in a division among the ruling elite that opened the way for the uprising that became the Commune. Finally, this is the group that would unleash terror on the Paris Commune, massacring upward of 25,000 people in street fighting that lasted nearly a week, arbitrary murders for days afterward, and around 50,000 sentenced to prison or bleak prison exile. The lessons here are complex and important for us. First, in pushing for more political power, the liberal bourgeoisie was quite willing to be publicly critical of social inequities, and the lavish expenditures by the rulers. With the workers' uprising, however, those liberal critics turned reactionary. As workers they thought they could control overstepped the boundaries set for them, became excessive in challenging property rights the bourgeoisie held sacred. Second, bourgeois power rests on dividing workers, urban from rural in 19th century France, skilled from unskilled, black from white in 20th century US, and by any social category they can use to promote divisions in our own times. Third, the bourgeois class and its state cared more for property than they did for human lives. Crushing the Paris Commune was what enabled the class alliance between the bourgeoisie and the large rural landowners, enabled, in other words, what became the so-called Third Republic. The massacre, not just the defeat of the Commune, but the massacre, served two purposes. It destroyed the class opposition from below, of course, but it also reassured the right wing, the landed aristocracy that still favored monarchy, that the new bourgeois republic could control the insurgent poor. Behind the political forms, empire, monarchy, republic, whatever, there are class forces. What form will our state take in the better society to come? And speaking of empire and imperialism, the French troops that were sent to massacre the Communards were brought back for that purpose from Algeria. They were country boys, systematically trained in ferocity to conquer a foreign population that resented and resisted their presence. Imperialism is also a threat to the population of the mother country and to efforts at social change there. I've been talking in much too quick a fashion about the Paris Commune and on its resonance and relevance for us on its 150th anniversary. This has been Norm Diamond for Another World is Possible on the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks to our other participants on today's show, Bill Resnick, Richard Smith, and Patricia Kohlberg. And a special thanks to the KBOO staff who've kept the station going under these strange and demanding circumstances. Tune in next Monday morning. Meanwhile, stay safe and stay active.